A lot of times people think it's more noble to go out and buy real estate because they can go put their hands on it, walk around on it. And they don't realize when they've invested a bunch of money in real estate, what they've actually done is not just buy themselves an asset, they've bought themselves a job.
Run your home and your dough like a biblical boss. You ready for this?
I'm ready.
Okay, I'm going to throw one thing. Mark's going to teach us for most of this episode, but I'm going to throw one thing out here that I was thinking about as we do these, we're going over financial assets. I remember one of the first things I ever owned, Mark, I don't even remember how I heard about it, but somebody told me about a stock that was mainly around potash. I didn't even know what that was.
I believe that the correct, at least Texan pronunciation of that word is potash.
Okay. I just know that it's used in fertilizer and like de-icing compounds. And I know that I bought this thing because of somebody's tip. It might've been Rob Pratt back in the day who gets, you know, said this thing's coming. That thing quadrupled, you know, in like a year and a half, and it blew my mind. And I remember thinking, if I can be wise here, I could really start to build something. Of course, it was small potatoes, the amount of money that I was doing back then. I felt like that was so exciting. Like I was looking at the vast landscape of possibility that could somehow benefit not only me, but my family long term. So Mark, I'm looking forward to you talking to us about that landscape, that world of possibility, and how we could be wise builders with all of these tools instead of just greedy short-term thinkers grasping at the next big idea. So lay it on us.
Well, I have to say a couple of things before I get to the laying it on you stage of the podcast.
We're patient.
Number one, I didn't know that story. I didn't know that that was your first financial investment. And
yeah.
I do know something about you, though, and it's that right now, if things haven't changed since we last discussed, you're working on kind of a country pop album. I can't think of many things that would be more cool than some sort of country song about your potash, your days like in the West Texas potash fields or whatever.
Of course.
So just think about it.
Yeah, thank you. Great idea.
But yeah, and then if you're just here for the finances, skip the next 60 seconds. But Stephen, I thought you would like this because you, when we travel, you're always game for finding something interesting to do that's kind of unique to a spot. I'm getting on a plane tomorrow morning. I'm going to go visit some clients of ours, and I'm also going to go see some family in the Missouri part of the world. So I'm flying into St. Louis. And I found that there was an opening to take my family up in the top of the St. Louis Arch. So I'm going to do that. And then I'm going to eat what many barbecue publications have rated the best ribs in America. So I'm looking forward to
what's the name of that joint?
Pappy's. Pappy's Barbecue in St. Louis. So if you've had them and you think they're terrible, you don't have time to warn me because by the time this goes out, it will have been done, but
I have not. But I will say that I have heard from many a person that going to the top of the arch is super claustrophobic.
I've heard that too. So I'm actually, I don't know. It only holds five people, so it's just our family in the little tram.
I think that is a wonderful bucket list activity. Go to the top of the St. Louis Arch.
So I'll report back once find out what it's like. I think our mutual buddy David Sheldon said it was one of the scariest experiences.
Oh, yes.
But let's get into it. Why do financial assets matter? And I think that, you know, in the circles you and I run in, it's very in vogue, and we're not opposed to it, to sort of talk about business ownership as the path to wealth creation, and maybe, you know, real estate, that's where the real multi-generational assets lie.
Right.
You talked about it, but I have bad news if you're cultivating a real estate empire because you believe that's what it means to build multi-generational family wealth. And it's that your chucklehead great-grandkids, if they have not been trained, can just as easily liquidate a real estate empire as they can spend cash in a bank account.
Absolutely true.
Also, at the Abraham's Wallet podcast, we kind of try to nudge people towards the idea that you want not only to have assets spread out amongst different investments, so you don't want all your wealth to be in Procter & Gamble stock. You should own a variety of financial investments. We also think you should own a variety of types of asset classes, and real estate is one of those. So is business ownership. Most people who own a business, that's where they will generate most of their wealth. And financial is another asset class. There's kind of Jewish tradition that says you should split your wealth a third, a third, a third between business, financial, and real estate assets. There's no biblical law about that, but it seems to actually be pretty wise when we look at how a lot of wealthy families and people have spread their money out. So nothing we're going to tell you today is telling you that this is the only asset class you should use. And a lot of the arguments against stocks that I hear are really based in a misunderstanding and sometimes even a glorification of other asset classes. A lot of times people think it's more noble to go out and buy real estate because they can go put their hands on it, walk around on it. And they don't realize when they've invested a bunch of money in real estate, what they've actually done is not just buy themselves an asset, they've bought themselves a job. So one of the great things about financial assets is typically they do not involve your labor in the same way that a business would, or even an apartment complex if you did that. So they can be very nice, truly passive investments. But I want you to understand what they are, because we don't think you should invest in things that you have no idea what they are. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of financial assets. We're going to spend probably most of our time, which won't be that much time, but on what are stocks and what are bonds. And then we'll talk about some of the stuff you may have heard, like, well, I've heard of mutual funds, or what about crypto? Kind of hit that real quick.
Yeah. Great.
Okay. Quick history lesson to get started. Capital markets started in 1602. You may have heard in history class the Dutch East India Company. You could buy shares in that company, just meaning they split ownership up and sold pieces of it to a whole bunch of people. So that was kind of your first opportunity to buy publicly traded stock. By the 18th century, the London Stock Exchange was cranking. And I kind of went down a rabbit hole this morning looking at what was it like to buy stocks and bonds, say, in the 1920s, the boomtown heyday, some would say irresponsible years that Americans' financial markets were booming. And there was ticker tape. You've seen that in old movies, ticker tape. I even had to think, what was that like? As somebody who buys and sells stocks for a living, what was it like to not have the internet? I was thinking, how did these little ticker tape machines even know what prices were? And the answer is, you would call your stockbroker and say, I want to buy some Coca-Cola stock. And then a human being would enter that trade and a telegram system would send out the information, and all the ticker tape machines in the country, whether they were in Chicago or New York or Dallas, were tuned to this frequency. If you're a if you're a telegraph expert, I'm probably simplifying this, but, and that little machine could be delayed by a minute or 2 minutes, but it would print out, okay, Coca-Cola just traded at this price. And that's how everybody in the country kind of knew that's the going price for one share of Coca-Cola. During times of crash, that ticker tape could get hours behind the actual trades happening in the market. And there were even people who got very, very wealthy because they figured out how to exploit those crash moments. But that was kind of how it worked. You had human beings running everything. And today you fast forward and we've got instant transactions. There's always a price available. You can get on Fidelity.com, or you can go to Robinhood on your Apple Watch and probably buy and sell stocks much more efficiently than the biggest investment banks in New York City could have done back then. So one of the things about financial assets that make them so appealing is they're very efficient and they're very available. So like I said, you don't have to really do much other than say, I've got $1,000. What could I invest it in that would grow for me? Just sort of in the same way that you're potash investment did for you when you were just a young man. So a stock is ownership in a company. You can own stock in a company that you and your brother started, and you sold stock to your four friends. That would be stock in a company. But when we think of stocks, a lot of times we think of publicly traded stocks. So there's stock exchanges where typically much larger companies list their equity, and you can go buy and sell it. And there's a market where you can kind of know this is the going price for that stock. So think about Apple or Coca-Cola. And these are long-term growth engines because typically companies that are publicly traded harness both innovation. So they aren't just a steady stream of money. They're saying we have good ideas to make, not just to sell our product, but to make new products and grow and enter new markets and all of that. And they can also beat inflation through the fact that, you know, if you make widgets and widgets get more expensive, well, you charge more for your widgets and you make more money. So your prices, as prices rise generally, your income should rise as well. That's true whether you own a private company or if you own stock in a public company. So you kind of get this double-sided financial weapon when you own stocks. I think this is a fun fact. If we think about Coca-Cola, just because it's been around a long time, if you bought a single share of Coca-Cola in 1919, it was $40, which is actually really expensive in 1919. $40 is a lot of money. But you could buy a share for $40. And that share, one share, would be worth $10 million by 2012. Now, a share of Coca-Cola obviously is not $10 million today. But that, as that company has grown and expanded, they've split the stock many, many times since then. Just meaning they cut it into more pieces. So they would say, hey, your share, it's 1927, sir, and we've decided your one share is worth 100 shares now so that more people can buy it. And that happened. So you didn't own less of the company, but you owned more shares because they just had more out there. So that's the magic of compound growth. Stocks both grow in their value. That's why I remember when I was a business student and stocks went from, I looked around and I said, every single kid at this MBA program is using a Macintosh. And they're telling me that in the workplace, no, Apple products are not for work. Apple products are just for people who use them for fun.
Yeah.
And I went, I don't think that's true. Now, this is not necessarily how I recommend to pick stocks. We'll get to it later. I don't actually recommend to pick stocks at all. But I bought some Apple, and I don't remember how much it cost. It was probably $80 a share, and it grew and grew and grew because, sure enough, businesses started adopting Apple products, and they became far more ubiquitous outside of just personal computers. And so that was growth in the stock price. But there's also this thing called dividends, where when you own a stock, if the company has extra money, and they're not investing all of it back into growth, they might go, well, we have extra money. Let's send it to the people who own this company. Steven, you and I, before we started recording, we're just talking about our business and saying, we're going to be distributing some of our cash because we don't need it to invest in people or products or things like that. So let's send it back to the owners. That's what dividends are. If you creep around the internet, you'll hear people that say, you should just build yourself a portfolio of dividend stocks. Like, high dividends are the best. And here's a hot sports opinion I have. It's maybe controversial. Dividend stocks, I would say, are kind of like investing in the unfaithful servant's talent. So the parable of the talents, Matthew 25. You remember one of them? He kind of got the money and then he went and buried it. And when the master returned, he said, I didn't know how to grow this. So here, you can have it back. A dividend stock is like saying, we don't have any opportunities to grow. We don't know how we would invest this in ourselves. So I guess just take it back. I'm not a big fan of dividend stocks. We'll talk about why when we get to bonds. But if you need just a stream of income, you can get a bond and you don't have to worry about the risk. Somebody could just cut the dividend. So dividend stocks, not my favorite, but they have a place. And most companies, even high growth companies like Apple are going to issue some dividends. I'm just not a fan of companies that have a huge, like 8% of the stock price dividends, because those usually mean those companies are not growing, they're shrinking.
Okay, here's my question. You're describing stocks as part of owning a company. Now, my family, we own an event planning company, and we get to decide we're going to do these moral events, and immoral events, we're not going to do them, or we're not going to advertise, I don't know, in some strip bar. We're not, you know, et cetera, because we can control that thing. So my question is getting to, if you own a stock and you own a teeny tiny portion of a business, what do you think, Mark? I just know that a lot of Christians are get very bent out of shape about you. Let's take your Coca-Cola stock. Well, I bought into Coca-Cola in 1915, and it was a delightful respite from the dirty water we drink, whatever, in 1915. And then I realized, oh, it's not nutritious. And now I have a moral quandary about that stock. And so I sell it. And then I go, wow, Coke is expanding to all these countries. And I think it's wonderful. And then I buy in. And then I find out, oh, they employed a child somewhere in Eastern Timor. Oh, I sell the stock. And it seems to me like if you want to keep tabs on the moral implications of every stock that you own, you have at least a part-time job. Where do you stand on the moral obligation to keep tabs on what all of your stock dollars are doing?
Yeah, because people know that I'm a Christian and a financial advisor that manages money for people, especially when we first started our company, we got hit up by so many companies who were kind of trading in this, hey, we can help you identify companies that are not evil, and you can invest your clients' assets in those companies. Don't invest in Apple because they sponsor the San Francisco Pride Parade. Instead, invest in fill in the blank. And you could do that. You could say, I will not own shares of any company that I'm not 100% on board with. My guess is that you would have a very hard time participating in the economy. And we could go, okay, so you won't own a share of Apple because they are pro everything you're against. But when you own a share of Apple, you get to vote on the decisions that they make. And if every Christian out there, or even everyone who just says, I have a moral stance that's more aligned with typical moral values, says, we're not going to own any companies that don't do what we like, then those companies will continue to spiral off into crazy town. Whereas what the approach that I like to take, and we even use companies that do this, is we own it all. And we'll talk about mutual funds and index funds, but we invest broadly in the whole market. And we just say, Outpost Advisors, even as a whole, thank God we manage quite a bit of money, but it's not a drop in the bucket for these big companies.
Yeah.
However, the pieces we own, we vote like Christians, and we use fund managers often who will vote like Christians. Big companies like Fidelity and Vanguard and BlackRock were famous recently for kind of using their humongous ownership stakes in these companies to vote against things that I was for. And so we took our voice, which is just our little dollars, and said, we're going to move from their funds over to a fund manager who probably charges the same fees, invests the same way, but votes their little ownership stake in accordance with our values. I like that a lot better, because once you say, well, I'm not going to own them, I go, okay, then you sure as heck better not buy their products. And if you don't buy their products, you, like I said, you're kind of extracting yourself from the economy. It's morally inconsistent to say, I would not own Apple, but I'm talking to you on an iPhone, or I would not, use Google. I wouldn't own a Google share, but I use Gmail. Like, those are not consistent positions. So you either have to go, I'm going to just go full monk style and isolate myself from everything, or, and I don't have a problem if that's where you land, but, or I'm going to participate in the economy like a believer. And even if it feels hopeless that my IRA account is not much of a drop in the bucket, I'm still just going to represent who I am with these dollars. And if I'm pushing up against a tidal wave morally or any other way, that's okay. Lord willing, others will come alongside me, and eventually we will have an impact if everybody behaves the same way.
Okay, that's fair. All right, that's stocks, owning part of a company. What else you got?
Well, the other piece of most people's like financial portfolio is bonds. You probably heard it, stocks and bonds.
Yep.
These usually are mentioned together. I think a lot of people don't really know what a bond is. So all a bond is money that you are lending to a company or a government. When we talk about the national debt in the United States, it's because we keep issuing bonds and borrowing money as a country. These bonds pay you interest and return your money at their maturity date. So it could be, I'm going to buy a $1,000 bond and it pays a 6% coupon. And that would mean, depending on the terms of the bond, I'm going to get paid 6% interest on that bond. And if it's a 1-year bond, at the end of that year, I get my $1,000 back. And the only way I don't get it back is if whatever entity I'm loaning money to goes under. So this is why treasuries, which are issued by the United States government, are typically thought of as risk-free from a principal standpoint, because most people say the U.S. government not going out of business. I guess that has gotten... That could be thrown into question if we keep borrowing at the rate we're borrowing now, but that's another podcast. Historically, I really thought this was fun. Owning a bond meant you got like an ornate paper certificate with detachable coupons. I've seen, my grandma had some of these when she died that were like, I actually went back and saw, could we redeem these at all? Like, and you would take scissors and clip the coupon and mail it off. And they would send you an interest payment via a check from the issuing company or the treasury. That's where we get the term bond coupons, which we still use today in the financial markets. We call them, this has a 6% coupon. Even though there's no clipping of coupons happening today, it comes from that. And I thought it was interesting, back when this was the case, bonds were an asset that if you held the certificate, you owned the bond, which is why so many people had a safety deposit box, and that's where they kept their bonds. Crazy to think about now that we just log in on our smartphones and look at our bond portfolios now, but it was a physical asset that just owning it meant you were entitled to those payments. There's lots of different types of bonds. I talked about treasuries. Those could be U.S. government treasuries. They could be issued by other countries. Corporates, which typically are issued by companies, and they are higher risk, but usually pay more. And that varies from really stable companies. You know, Procter & Gamble issues bonds. Those are probably very low risk compared to really, they call them junk bonds, which might have to pay 15%, but there's a risk that that company goes out of business and you don't get your money back. There's even municipal bonds, which is... There's a provision in the tax code which says municipalities, so the city of Cincinnati, can issue bonds to finance projects. And the U.S. Treasury says we're not going to tax the interest that you make on those bonds. The other thing you need to know about bonds is that typically people hold bonds as kind of a counterbalance in their investment accounts to stocks. So these tend to move in opposite directions. When the economy gets really hairy and people start getting nervous about companies, stocks respond really quickly to changes in the economic environment. Oh no, we think there's a huge recession coming. So all of our guesses about how much money these companies were going to make, they might actually be a lot lower. So we're not going to pay as much for those. That's what happens when stock prices drop. At the same time, when people sell their stock, often they flood their money over into the bond side of the market and say, let's just put it in somewhere safe, like U.S. treasuries, things like that. And so those two asset classes tend to move opposite of each other.
I've heard of diversification. And I think that means that not all of my money is in the potash stock. The idea is if I can have money in 10 strong companies, I'm safer than if I have my money in one company that I'm hoping everything on. But here's the problem, Mark. I don't have enough money to buy one stock, just one, in all of the companies that I'm interested in or that would be safe. How could I possibly invest in more companies than I can afford?
Yeah, so this was a problem from almost the beginning of capital markets in the United States. People wanted to own a variety of investments.
Sure.
But they didn't necessarily want to buy their own individual stocks. And I would say by the time I was a youth, it was just the norm that people were still making stock picks. And if you've gone and seen like The Wolf of Wall Street or some of these movies, there was definitely stockbrokers that would call you up and give you a hot tip. I remember listening to your dad talk about the hot stock tips he got at the water cooler and things like that.
Yeah.
But I think the idea that you should invest in broadly diversified portfolios was pretty broadly accepted maybe the 80s or the 90s. And the way that most people were doing that at that time was through mutual funds. So mutual funds have existed since 1924, and all they are is a vehicle to pool money. So you would have a mutual fund company that would say, you can invest your money with us. We will buy a whole bunch of different stuff. And in the early days, it was definitely sold as like, I am a smart investor. I can beat just the overall stock market. I can kind of pick individual companies. And if you invest in me, I can do better for you than what you would get on your own. But it would be basically buying one asset, which is a share in a mutual fund company. And that mutual fund manager would then buy, sell, trade to try and grow your money. And you're really kind of buying stock in that mutual fund company, if you want to think of it that way. Although that's not exactly how it works. That's kind of how it functions for people. The cons to this were those mutual fund managers that were holding themselves out as market geniuses. They wanted to get paid. So a lot of times, especially in the early days, mutual funds would have really, really high fees. I still see this all the time. People come in and they go, my previous financial advisor sold me these mutual funds and they've done great. And I go, well, you pay 2% fee here.
Right.
You're making 10% a year. That's not actually that great. And you don't really have much control over what you're investing in, especially if you're just saying, I'm going to trust somebody to pick stocks. We kind of know now that picking stocks is not a winning game. There has I've said this before, there has never been a money manager in the United States who beat the stock market for 20 years in a row. Never happened. So the idea that I'm going to do better by just picking stocks, whether you're a professional or just an amateur investor, it's not likely to be the case. You're typically better just saying, I want to own all the companies. And so this change happened over time. We went from mutual funds with stock pickers to mutual funds that went, actually, this index exists, the S&P 500, so 500 of the largest companies in the country. What if we just made a mutual fund where we owned all of those, and maybe Steve Emanuel can't afford to buy a share of all of those, but we can afford to buy a whole bunch of all of those and weight it appropriately to just track the index. Well, then people could invest $100 with us and they would own a little tiny piece of all of the S&P 500. And our job now is not to pick winners and losers. It's to just track the index, and people basically can own the entire market. And they got better and better at this until it was like, forget the S&P 500. What if we owned every stock available in the United States? You could do that. And then somebody came along and said, now mutual funds, that's nice, but there's some real limitations there. For example, you can't trade a mutual fund in the middle of the day. It's not a stock. It's a company that you redeem shares in. So every night the market closes, and if you want to sell your mutual fund, you turn in a redemption and they'll send you your money back the next day. Well, there's reasons why that's not as efficient, but people said, what if we just started a company that did the same thing, but we sold shares in our company like it was a Coca-Cola, but instead of making Coke, we just own stocks. That's our company. And those were called exchange traded funds because they
Okay, this is a different thing now.
Now we're moving on to kind of the next evolution. You could have the exact same investment strategy as a mutual fund now, but it's trading like a stock. So this was started in 1993 with the SPDR. It's SPDR, but it's people call it the SPDR S&P 500 ETF. And fun fact, we still hold that specific ETF in people's portfolios that we manage today. It's a good one, very inexpensive, very efficient. And we don't own any shares of the Dutch East India Trading Company. That would be cool if we still were using the original stock, but we are using the original ETF here and there. And typically these guys have way lower fees. So instead of paying 1%, now we're paying like 0.03% to get those types of exposures.
Okay. If an ETF has lower fees, you can trade them all day long and you still get the diversity, why would you ever own a mutual fund over an ETF?
It's a good question, Stephen. And I'll tell you, the kind of textbook answer is there's mutual funds that allow kind of automatic monthly contributions that kind of end up being like an investment advisor, something an advisor might do for you, which is like, we can just set up a monthly contribution to our fund. There's some fund managers who still hold themselves out and go, I'm still smarter than everyone else and I can beat the market and I deserve my 2% mutual fund fee. There's that. There is some concern over like bid ask spread. So when you look at a stock, the price you see, there's actually always a spread between the bid price and the ask price. And meaning you might say, if I just place an order for Coca-Cola stock and I don't specify the max I'm willing to pay, I might actually pay a little more than I thought I was going to. Whereas a mutual fund, there's, like I said, a daily redemption price. There's no question what you're going to pay for a share. You know, those are all true, I guess. But nowadays, I don't see a whole lot of reason ever to use mutual funds over ETFs, because even if we look at a big company like Vanguard, they have an S&P 500 mutual fund and they have an S&P 500 ETF and they have the exact same holdings. One's just a little bit more tax efficient and a little bit less expensive. So I don't see a huge reason to stick with mutual funds unless there's one that you just particularly like.
All right. We got stocks, bonds, mutual fund, which is a basket of stocks, and ETFs, which is like a company that's owning stocks and acting like its own company. Is that it for asset classes?
Yeah, and the one thing I would say about ETFs is now you can have an ETF that does almost anything. So if you wanted an ETF that just tracked the price of gold, you can buy an ETF that just owns a giant pile of gold. And your investment now, it's pretty tricky to go out and buy gold bars. There's costs to trading those. You could just take $100 and say, I want to have the same price appreciation and everything that I would get if I owned $100 worth of gold. But now it's super efficient. I don't have to buy a safe to keep my gold and I can just own this gold ETF. So it's not just stocks and bonds now. ETFs track all sorts of things, including the new kid on the block, which is there are even ETFs that allow you to track the price of cryptocurrencies,
right?
Bitcoin or others. So let's talk about the new player in financial assets, which is
please
crypto.
Let's. We're talking on a day where Bitcoin is right at 110,000, right at pushing 110,000 right now.
Yeah. I think that this is a place where I expect you to have a few chirps because I know you are what they call a crypto maximalist.
Oh, wow.
you like the Bitcoin. I was on Twitter the other day and I heard somebody say, there are only two cryptocurrencies that matter, and everything else you can is just a waste of your time. And I'm thinking, oh, he's going to say Bitcoin and like some other really pop. And he's like Bitcoin and like Maxi Flycoin. And I'm like, well, what are you talking about, you mook?
Right, right.
But, you know, crypto, really Bitcoin's 2008 white paper kind of started the public awareness, I would say, of Bitcoin. Cryptocurrencies run on decentralized blockchain technology. The reason people like them is kind of like gold. Gold, you can't just snap your fingers and make more gold the way that dollar bills can just be run off a printing press. And all of a sudden, you may not know this, but that's what inflation is. All our dollar bills are worth less when they just churn out a whole bunch more dollar bills. Crypto, especially currencies like Bitcoin, there's a limited amount of it, and you don't need to understand all the technology to just know that just like anything that we use to represent a store of value, Bitcoin specifically we can talk about is something that everybody has said, we have decided to assign value to this because there is a finite, limited amount, and you can't go make more, and there's no involvement of outside banks that get to manipulate the prices and things. It's just peer-to-peer, whatever you're willing to say this is worth, if you want to change it for dollars, that's what it's worth.
Right.
And so, in any case, Steve, people have decided it's worth a lot more than they used to think it was worth. In 2010, the first, I think, transaction that we know about where Bitcoin was used to buy a physical good was somebody bought a pizza with Bitcoin, and they paid 10,000 Bitcoins for pizza, which you just said the price right now is about $110,000.
Yes, correct.
That's a lot of zeros.
Yes.
Roughly, what, $1 trillion? Am I getting that wrong?
That's quite a pizza. Yes. So my understanding is that voting with your dollars for something like Bitcoin is like saying, I believe that the dollar is going to be worth something. So I'm going to work towards saving up not just an asset that a dollar can get, but the dollar itself. You're saying, I believe that a dollar will play on the world stage and it'll become more valuable for people to have dollars. That's what people are doing with regard specifically to Bitcoin, is saying, I believe that Bitcoin is going to widen in its use. And we now see in 2025, we see nations that are now getting into Bitcoin and think that it is a reasonable asset class for them to have. Well, that's exactly what you're betting on, is that it will expand in use. One of the values of Bitcoin is that it's not given to the whims of a Congress that can just print more of them and devalue the whole thing. So that's the idea behind it.
And I think this is another, like I said, you can buy an ETF that owns Bitcoin, and that's all it is you could say, well, I don't know if I want to get involved in the ins and outs of how to buy it and trade this stuff and cold storage wallets and all the stuff that's involved. You and I have even had unfortunate experience where we had a bunch of our crypto go poof because we invested it with that white boy Afro kid who stole everybody's crypto about, I don't know, 4 years ago. So I think that there's ways to participate in this if it's something you believe in. And with all of these assets, I would say this is true. You could kind of boil down how you want to approach this stuff by the simple don't put all your eggs in one basket idea. And that's where the vehicles like mutual funds and ETFs are very useful to helping you just say, I'm not going to place bets. I'm going to own markets. I'm going to cast my bread upon the waters. And I'm going to put a little bit in crypto. I'm going to put a little bit in American companies. I'm going to put some in foreign companies. I'm going to put some in treasury bonds and other money into corporates. And it's become pretty easy to diversify yourself across asset classes now. And that's really what we encourage.
You started to answer it, but I think that when people are hearing these different asset classes, naturally your mind goes to, okay, well, I've got my first $1,000 I can invest. Am I supposed to buy an equal amount of all of these asset classes? Is that what the wise and prudent thing to do is? Who can help me? How do I know how to use these things? If I have a loose definition of them, great. But what am I supposed to do?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, the answer to that is we could spend 7 hours podcasting about asset allocation. If you really want to know what we think at Abraham's Wallet, and you're, if that's you specifically, I have $1,000. What am I supposed to do if I want to spread my money around? You could go to abrahamswallet.com. We'll link it to this article and or to this podcast. We wrote an article called Asset Allocation for Abrahamic All-Stars, where we actually said, if you only have a little bit of money, don't overcomplicate things. Definitely don't go buy 25 different ETFs at $10 each and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But, you know, typically with a very small amount of money, even when I'm managing for a client, maybe somebody starts an account for their child and they say, well, this only has $1,000 in it now. We don't do the same things in that account that we do with their $1 million IRA. We say, let's keep this one pretty simple and let's have a little bit of stocks in the United States exposure, a little bit of stocks across the rest of the world exposure, and a little bit of bonds. And that might be it. We might only have 3 ETFs in that portfolio. We actually, you'll be pleased, often mix in between 2% and 4% of crypto into those portfolios if it's somebody who that's something they're open to and kind of want that exposure. But we don't get crazy. As your wealth grows, you can go, I'm going to tack on some things that I have conviction about to that list. I think I actually want emerging markets. So there's a big difference between owning all the companies that are publicly traded in the UK and all the companies that are publicly traded in Brazil or India. They perform very differently, different risks, etc. So I would say if you're looking for a deep dive on how, go check out that article. And maybe it's something that we'll be able to dig into in a future episode.
Okay. What if the thing I feel passionate about is owning a little ranch outside of Fredericksburg?
I mean, I think that's a great thing to feel passionate about.
I'm trying to tee you up to talk about real estate, Mark.
Yeah. Two things to close. Real estate is something, again, that a lot of our listeners are interested in. You can actually own real estate via financial assets. There's a few ways to do it. You may have heard of REITs, real estate investment trusts. These are companies kind of like not that different from mutual funds, but instead of owning shares of companies, a REIT owns real estate. And there's different types of REITs. Some of them own apartment buildings. Some of them own all sorts of diversified things in real estate. Others are very targeted. Some of them don't even own any land or buildings. They just own debt on real estate. So they finance real estate projects. And you can buy and trade those like stocks. So that's a very easy way to participate in real estate. If you said, I'm a renter in San Francisco and it's just impossible for me to own any real estate in terms of like my home, or I'm not going to buy a rental home, but I want some real estate in the mix. You could do that via a REIT very easily. You can also do syndications. So sometimes somebody will say, I see a huge opportunity. I want to buy a ranch in Fredericksburg and I think I can make $1 million a year, but it costs $15 million to buy this and I don't have it. So instead of trying to convince a bank to give me a loan, I'm going to cobble together a group of owners. And just like if I was starting a mutual fund, sort of, I'm going to take all their money, pool it. But instead of buying a whole bunch of things, I'm just going to buy this ranch, operate it, and return the money to the investors. And maybe we sell it or refinance it after 10 years. That's called a syndication deal. And we could do whole episodes on syndication, but sometimes syndications own multiple properties. Often they are put together for specific properties and they can be awesome investments. They can be horrible investments. And it really just depends on the person running the syndication. The one things I will say is they always promise great returns, of course, because they're marketing. They're trying to sell to investors. But usually they're very illiquid, meaning unlike a stock or a bond, you can't go, I need that money, sell the stock. You instead typically have your money tied up for years in these syndication deals. So it's not something that you would go like a REIT, I can just go redeem it. A syndication, I'm in until they tell me, okay, we sold the property, here's your money back. And then of course you can go buy real estate, but that's not a financial asset at that point. We consider that
right.
a different thing.
Right. Okay. Listen, folks, we want you to be equipped and we want you to be savvy when you're wading into the waters of investment. So that's why Mark's trying to give us some good definitions for understanding what a stock is and what bonds are, mutual funds, ETFs, crypto, how it's used, REITs, and even syndications. These financial assets, all of these different ways of investing, that's your toolkit for growing wealth without trading your family time for a second job. They're all accessible, they're flexible, and they're backed by centuries of innovation. But they're only as good, and Mark said this at the top, they're only as good as your stewardship. So commit to learning one new thing about financial assets this month. Maybe you want to research a stock. Go research Coke. Just look at that stock. Understand the call prices, et cetera. Explore an ETF. Maybe talk to a financial advisor that shares your values. And then why don't you share that learning with your wife or a trusted brother in the Abe's Wallet community? We like to cheer for each other as we're stewarding our wealth together, however large that wealth pile is, for God's glory. Jeremy Pryor likes to say family leadership is about building systems that last, and that's what your job is when it comes to investing. So start small, sure, but let's pray big and let's learn how to run our dough like biblical bosses. We'd love for you to join the Abraham's Wallet community at abrahamswallet.com/support. So that you can swap stories and tips and encouragement with other Abrahamic families who are chasing God's kingdom in their homes. When it comes to investing your money for long-term wealth, let's go!